Since the 1800s, Hickok & Boardman Insurance Group has been providing quality service and peace of mind to our clients. With our offices in Burlington, Stowe, and St. Albans, and our Dennis Ricker & Brown offices in Montpelier and Lynnonville, we are here when you need us.
And now WDEV-FM and AM presents our two-hour public affairs program, Open Mic with Mike Smith. Important topics, topical guests, and your phone calls. And now here's the host of Open Mic, Mike Smith.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us this morning. What a packed program today. Up first, Congressman Peter Welch will call in from Philly and share with us his impressions of the Democratic National Convention and his position on other national issues. Then Ken Horstman, a former state employee, will join us in studio. Ken believes that political appointees hinder rather than help productivity in state government. We'll ask him why. And then after we check in with our colleagues at Talk Media News, Rutland Herald and Times Argus reporter Neil Goswami will report on the happenings in Philly. And finally, Shap Smith, a Democratic lieutenant governor candidate, will join us right here in studio, and we'll see where he stands on various issues. But like I said, busy program, so let's get right to it. On the line joining us from Philly is Congressman Peter Welch. Good morning, Congressman Welch.
Good morning, Mike.
Congressman, before we turn to the Democratic National Convention and national issues of importance, on most pages of today's papers, in Vermont at least, there's a report that you've made a decision to reverse course and not take any more money from Comcast. And the reason is because your wife, Margaret Cheney, sits on the Public Service Board, and there's a case before her now with Comcast. Why did you make the decision now?
Well, really, to go the extra mile. You know, some of the folks brought this to our attention. I didn't know that Margaret was on a case involving Comcast. She didn't know that I had gotten a contribution. And obviously, I report my contributions, and they're all totally within the law. But to really try to go the extra mile, I've just decided, look, let's not have this doubt be out there as to whether a contribution I get for my political campaign somehow influences what goes on before the Public Service Board. So I want to thank the folks who brought this to my attention, and we're just going to have this policy where we make certain that any contributions I get don't involve people that are appearing before the Public Service Board.
So that would apply to all utilities and all sort of parties that are appearing before the Public Service Board?
Yeah, folks who are before the Public Service Board, and where some folks might ask the question whether somehow a contribution to Welch for Congress influences the Public Service Board, is related. So I want to just put that to rest. But, you know, Mike, there's, I think for a lot of people who are in public service, whether it's on a school board or in Congress or the Public Service Board, a lot of them have partners. They're married, and they each have a job. I have my job. Margaret has her job. And it is, I think, in the world we're in, both of us do our jobs as responsibly as we possibly can. But I think all of us want to try to do whatever we can to make people feel secure that however I make a decision or anyone else does, it's about the merits of the decision, not because of any influence that comes from making a contribution, in this case, to my political campaign.
Does this apply to employees of utilities as well?
Yeah, I think I would have it include employees of utilities as well.
Let me ask this, Congressman Welch, and then we'll move on to the Democratic National. Why do you need $8 million from Comcast, and why build up a war chest of almost $1 million when you don't have an opponent?
Well, two things. First, it was not Mike, $8 million.
I'm sorry, $8,000.
And that's about 1%. Let me tell you, we have a problem with money in politics, and Citizens United has created a situation where any millionaire or billionaire who wants to come in and influence a race has unlimited capacity to do it at any moment. And it makes the fact that you're in a strong position at a moment not necessarily so secure, because I've seen this in races across the country. A person who has a lot of cash can decide they're going to come to Vermont, they're going to come to New Hampshire, and they're going to start a super PAC, and they're going to overwhelm you with an immense amount of money. So if you're in an office and you're trying to make certain that you're going to be in a strong position to withstand an attack from the outside, then having a campaign account where you can fight back is a good thing. Now, having said that, one of the reasons I've supported a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United, one of the reasons I'm a strong sponsor of campaign finance reform that would include public financing and limiting how much we can spend, is to try to establish level rules that apply across the board and would take big money out of politics. But we're a long way from getting that done. So what I do now is have full disclosure, as the law requires, full transparency on every single contribution I get, and full transparency on every expenditure I make.
Turning to the Democratic National Convention, what is your hope people will take from this convention?
I think two things. First of all, I want to start by talking a little bit about Bernie Sanders.
I'll get to that.
Okay. Well, what we want to take away is something that I think Bernie's given us the opportunity to take away, and that's that we're unified. We're unified as a party that wants to stay in the fight in these difficult times to improve the situation for folks who are struggling to make ends meet. The challenges of income inequality, the unaddressed challenge of climate change, we're united on that, and I think Bernie's had a big role in doing it. So that's what we're going to come out of this with, in my view. We're going to come out with a unified Democratic Party that's going to be reaching out in a combined and aggressive effort to win this election and defeat Donald Trump.
Let's talk. You brought it up, and let's talk about Bernie Sanders for a minute. You've been a supporter of Bernie Sanders. You've also been a supporter of Debbie Wasserman Schultz. Did Schultz put her foot on the scale in favor of Clinton? And she has resigned, but should others resign at the Democratic National Committee?
Well, Debbie did the right thing. I mean, with those email leaks, it's pretty clear that the DNC did put a finger on the scale. It's something that Bernie was complaining about. I had no idea that that was the case, but those emails indicate that that is the case. And Bernie had a right to complain, and he did. And Debbie Wasserman Schultz, as a result of that, made herself the issue. And I think she did the right thing by taking herself out of the middle of it, and she's no longer the issue. I don't know that other people should resign. I mean, that's the type of thing where it really does require leadership at the top to take the responsibility for what has happened there.
One of the moments that was moving to the participants at the convention was the mothers of African Americans killed by police. Are police racist?
No. Police are public servants. My goodness, you know, my stepson was a police officer for several years. That what we ask police to do is so, so challenging, Mike. I mean, they have to respond to calls where it's an older person whose precious cat is in a tree, or they have to, literally, and they give some peace of mind to that person, or they have to respond to a call where there's a crime going on and there's an armed person who's threatening public safety. They have to do everything, and the expectation is they'll do it with dignity, they'll do it with restraint, and by and large, that's the case. No, I think I am so impressed with our police officers, and I think all of us want to show our respect for what they do. And these shootings of police officers, they're just astonishing. It really makes my heart break where, as a result of wearing a uniform, some people literally ambush and kill police officers. No, our police officers are good people.
Do Black Lives Matter, or do all lives matter, or is it a combination of both?
Well, all lives matter. The Black Lives Matter movement, I think, is reflecting the fact that there has been there's a lot of problems in our criminal justice system. Okay, you can't blame all of those on any one factor, but there's indisputable evidence that the incarceration rate among young black males, that the war on drugs, that the kind of revenue enhancement programs that were used in Missouri where we had that shooting, all of that leads to real difficulty and tension in the African-American community. So we, and I think President Obama has been really, really good on this, we respect our police officers, and it's absolutely inexcusable for there to be violence against police. These ambushes are completely inexcusable. But we do have problems in our criminal justice system that we've got to face and we've got to address so that there's confidence that there isn't a race-based component to it.
What does Hillary Clinton have to do tonight at the convention in her speech?
I think she's got to build on what President Obama did last night. I think what he did that was, in my view, so brilliant is that without anger, without hostility, without accusation, he really kind of disassembled and undressed the emptiness of the Trump approach in his campaign. And what he really was able, I think, from my perspective, to portray was that Mr. Trump has grievances, but literally no solutions. He literally doesn't come up with a plan that has any chance of addressing any of the issues that he's talking about. And what Hillary has as a challenge is to be somewhat more likable and persuadable. And President Obama showed how that can be done, and he really set the table for her. So I think what she has to do is show in tone an affirmative, relatable accessibility to the American voter. You know, she's the most famous unknown person that we have running for office. Her negative numbers are high. She's got an opportunity, I think, to try to bring those down.
Poll after poll shows that many of the American public don't trust her. How does she address that?
Candor. You know, I think that she's got to be candid, and part of this, you know, is a challenge for her because, as she has said, Bill Clinton and I think President Obama are gifted. I mean, you've been around politics a lot, and they just have an ability, in my view, especially Obama, to be credible and to be relaxed and to be relatable. Not all of us in this business have those. Very few of us have those skills, and Hillary's, I think, communication skills just don't match that, and that's the expectation. But what I think we've seen is that when she gets a job, she likes to do the job, and she relaxes. And I don't know her, really. I've met her, but I really don't know her. I've not worked with her. But my colleagues who do know her and have worked with her, they say that in person, she's very down to earth, very easy to work with, very responsive. But can she convey in public that persona that my colleagues say exists in private?
We're speaking with Congressman Peter Welch. If you wish to join our conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. We've been speaking about the Democratic National Convention, but I'm going to turn our attention to other national issues. And Congressman, maybe a month ago you participated in a sit-in on the House floor over gun control. What was the purpose of that sit-in?
You know, the purpose was to try to bring attention, much more attention, to the failure of Congress to do anything in response to the mass shootings that we've been having all too frequently. You know, one of the things that has been very frustrating, I think, for all of us, is that we've had like 31 moments of silence in Congress after mass shootings from Newtown, where those children got slaughtered in their grammar school, to Orlando. And every time we have a moment of silence, and this is in Congress where it's our job to try to come up with some positive steps to abate the violence, the moment of silence is followed by complete inaction. Complete inaction. And, you know, it's our job to be having a debate and having committee hearings and then to be having votes on measures that have at least some significant common sense applicability. Like the biggest one for me is, shouldn't we have a background check apply basically to everybody that's buying a gun and not have these big loopholes where if you go across the street and buy a gun at a gun show, there's no background check, but if you go into Sam's Sporting Goods, there is. And what you saw was the members who participated in that were expressing the intense frustration that we have that the majority won't even allow a committee hearing, let alone a vote on the floor on any legislation. And it clearly got a lot of attention, an enormous amount of attention. but we still don't have the opportunity for a vote.
Congressman, you mentioned Newtown and the tragedy that happened there. And you mentioned background checks, but a background check wouldn't have prevented that tragedy. And actually an analysis, and this was in the summer, in the spring of this year, analysis by the Washington Post showed that most of the mass shootings that have shocked us wouldn't have been prevented by what you just proposed.
Yeah, Mike, there's truth to that, and I think all of us who are saying that we should take some common sense steps to do some basic things that might help, that even if we do them, like have people who are on the terrorist watch list can't get a gun until they get off it or are vetted, or the full background checks, my view, those would help. But I'm not trying to make any claim that that would solve the problem altogether. But the fact that we can't come up with, quote, a solution that would provide assurance to all of us that all of us would obviously love to have no more Newtowns, no more Orlandos, doesn't mean that we shouldn't do what we can do that makes sense to do. So it's not an all-or-nothing thing. But what's happened in the gun debate is that you've got a Second Amendment, which I support, and I know you're a strong supporter of the Second Amendment, but the Second Amendment is like the First Amendment, free speech. I'm a strong supporter of that. But you can't yell fire in a crowded theater. And because if you do that, using your right to speak, you're going to create havoc and probably a lot of injury. The Second Amendment, there are some limitations on you can't go buy a bazooka. You can't buy a rocket launcher. I mean, there's even Justice Scalia is very clear that there's some limits, like the legitimacy of laws that create some safe zones, say, around schools. So we're not even having the discussion in the debate. That's the frustration. But any of us who think that we should proceed with some what I would call common sense reforms or should not be trying to oversell that, especially when some of these mass shootings, by definition, the person who does it is really, really sick.
I don't want to dwell on this, but just to quickly, what was the purpose? You said it brought a lot of attention. I'm wondering, did it bring the right kind of attention? Because most people believe Washington, D.C. is a mess and nothing gets done. Does a sit-in bring sort of elevate the feeling that Washington, D.C. is a mess? And secondly, the Senate had already rejected all the proposals that you and others, including Republicans, had talked about. This was going nowhere anyway, wasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a fair question, Mike. And by the way, I also think the sit-in is a violation of House rules. And, of course, I was there with John Lewis, really kind of the leader on this, and he's famous for the sit-ins and civil disobedience he did in the cause of civil rights, which, when we look back historically, all of us have great admiration for him. But if you violate the rules, then those of us who did, if the speaker were to impose some punishment, we should accept it. And I think that's got to be part of this. But you make a point that, of course, I've been making about the dysfunction of Washington. And this was a collision between a situation where the majority has the total authority to allow for there to be a committee hearing, allow for there to be a vote, on a topic that has enormous public concern. And there's debate, yes or no, all of us would be held accountable. So it's a tough call because ideally we would be working through the committee process. We'd be given confidence that we'd have a hearing and we'd be able to then have our vote up or down.
I'm sorry, did I interrupt?
No, thank you.
Can you give us an update on getting ethanol out of our gasoline?
Hey, we're making some progress. I'll tell you why we're making progress. I just love this. I got involved in ethanol because Vermonters brought it to my attention. I was clueless about how bad it was for our small engines, and I didn't know how it was hammering our farmers who were dependent on grain. And I found out about it by being at a country fair up in Highgate, and folks told me about it, and I started looking into it, and I was appalled. And when I first got involved in this fight, a few years ago, a lot of people in the environmental community were appalled that I did. But I said, hey, wait a minute, this is an environmental disaster as well. you know, we're doing row-to-row planting in the Midwest Corn Belt, and it's destroying habitat and wetlands. So I'm finding I'm starting to pick up a lot of Democratic support, along with some Republican support. And I've just introduced a new bill with a Texas oil guy, Bill Flores. He and I don't see eye to eye on anything, Mike, but we do see eye to eye on ethanol, and to some extent for different reasons. And we're starting to round up sponsors, and on the Energy and Commerce Committee, there's a lot of interest in the question I have is whether we'll get a hearing on it this year, and possibly if we actually had a hearing on it, and we've got a lot of folks in the environmental community now joining me in their opposition to the corn-based ethanol. And I think we have a long-shot chance of getting a vote on the floor this year, but I think a really good chance in the next Congress to get a vote on it. So we're making progress. And keep in mind, we got rid of the tax subsidy. That saved taxpayers $6 billion. We got rid of the tariff barrier, which was about 54 cents a gallon. And now we've gotten EPA to stay at E10 rather than go up to E15. We want to put that into law. So we're making progress, and I thank Vermonters for really opening my eyes to what I think is a major problem.
Congressman, I got one phone call waiting, has been waiting. I've only got about a minute, maybe 90 seconds on it. Can you, let's go to Fred in Newberry. Fred, I apologize. It seems every time you come in, you're coming in right at the end. Can you make it real quick?
Yeah, real quickly. I think the forgotten man is going to determine this election, and Trump will win.
Congressman?
You know, the forgotten man needs to be remembered. I'm totally in agreement with you because, as President Obama and Joe Biden said last night, the folks have been working hard and haven't had a raise. And, you know, Trump talks about that, but he doesn't have a solution for it. That's the question I have. But I got to say, I think it's tough for everyday folks who have been trying to pay the bills, put their kids through school, have a job where they can have some security in retirement. That's tough, and that's the big challenge that all of us face. And my question about Mr. Trump is he points out the problem, but does he have a solution?
Congressman Peter Welch, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Mike.
That's Congressman Peter Welch. Coming up, Ken Horstmann, former state employee and manager. We're going to talk about political appointees. Do they hinder government effectiveness and efficiency? This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. John, I love the head-banging music. That is so great for a bumper. Welcome back to Open Mic. It's my pleasure to have us joining us in our WDEV studios, Ken Horstmann, former state employee and manager. And we're going to talk about political appointees because Ken has some opinions about political appointees. Good morning, Ken.
Good morning, Mike. Glad to be here.
Ken, can you sort of give us a little bit of your background, including you haven't been a lifelong employee. You've been a long-time former state employee. You're retired now. But can you give us a little bit about your background?
Sure. I had a 20-plus year career in public television. I was executive producer, created shows like Vermont This Week, which Vermonters still see to this day, and I really enjoyed it. And then I had my own business for 5 or 6 years, and then left that to do some communications work with Vermont Farm Bureau, and left Farm Bureau to take a communications position in 1999 with the state of Vermont.
And was that a classified position or was that a political appointee position?
No, initially it was a political appointee position. It was an exempt position, as it was called. And then shortly into it, about a year into it, it was made into a classified position, a full-time, permanent, non-appointed position.
And that was in what department?
It was in the Agency of Commerce, Department of Economic Development, which is the department that contains Housing, Community Affairs, Vermont Life, Historic Preservation Division, and does really a lot of very important and good work.
You have a problem with political appointees in state government. Why?
Well, I do for this reason, because the bottom line is I think that Vermonters are not getting the bang for their buck from the state workforce, the line workers, because the workforce is not valued, is not empowered. And in my experience, primarily deputy commissioners, these were the people who were sort of the assistants to the commissioners, sort of reverted to an admin role. Not always. I mean, that's not to say that they weren't involved in policy work at all. But largely, they were in charge of the timesheets and, you know, keeping track of the personnel stuff. And largely because of our revolving door system. I mean, when I came into state government, the average tenure of a commissioner was about 2 years. And you know, as Secretary of Administration, when you take these jobs, it's hard work. And your life is not your own, particularly during the legislative session. And so for two reasons, I think what results, the revolving door mitigates against really good management of the workforce, and the fact that these people are just plain busy. They just have a lot on their plate. And in VT Digger today, the state auditor comes out with a report that says that only 15% of employees in three branches he looked at, three departments, including human resources, did their statutorily required annual performance reviews. In my last 2 years of state government, and I was in state government for 16 years, so my last 2 years, I didn't get an evaluation. Now, that's a symptom of a problem, and the problem is that there's not real effort and work or time for that effort and work going into making that workforce as good as it can be. Tom Huebner, who used to head the, I'm not sure if he still does, maybe still does, the Rutland Regional Medical Center. I saw a presentation about 10 years ago. They were making some changes within the hospital. Did a staff-wide survey and was asking them, so what's most important to you? And I don't think their answers were that different than what state workers would say. Number one was to be valued. And I think most employees really want that. The second thing was that management had their back. The third thing was flex time. Money was like fourth or fifth down the list. And again, I don't think that the state workforce answers would be that much different.
I'm not sure any organization would be that much different.
Right. I agree. And you know from your experience, most state workers care deeply, work hard under difficult circumstances across state government. And they deserve better. Taxpayers, me, I deserve better from the workforce.
So what's the solution?
Well, one idea would be, and I've had long discussions with my state representative, Martin Lalonde, who used to work in the Federal Department of Justice. And years ago, before we created these deputy commissioners, there were full-time classified positions called directors that provided continuity to an incoming administration, tremendously helpful to get them hitting the ground running, understanding the procedures, but also developing a relationship long-term with the workforce so that they were able to say, hey, you know, Mike really has strengths in this area, or let's use Lucy, you know, in this area, not this. There was institutional memory. There was continuity. They did away with them. And they created these deputy commissioners. One idea, and I'm not very optimistic that's going to happen because I think politicians like to make political appointments. One idea would be to reestablish these director positions, as what is the case in federal government. My state representative told me that when he worked for the Department of Justice, the line workforce reports to a full-time employee, and the appointees come in, and they come and they go. That's an idea.
So what the organizational structure would look like, just so that I'm clear on this, would be you'd have a commissioner, you'd have a director, and you wouldn't have a deputy commissioner.
Potentially. Mm-hmm. Maybe there needs to be a deputy for the particular agency or department. I think that's a discussion that has to happen by people more knowledgeable than I. But for example, in the Department of Economic Development, the deputy position was eliminated for budget reasons, which exacerbated the problem. because now, as a line worker, I'm reporting to the commissioner. Oh, good. You know, she doesn't know her name. She's torn in all directions, difficult to deal with, and the situation was made worse. So I think we'd have to – I'm raising the issue, and I think the discussion would have to have a lot more thought put into it as to how the structure would work agency by agency and commissioner by commissioner or department by department. Yeah.
We're speaking with Ken Horstman, former state employee.
Can I just correct you? I was never a manager.
Okay. I was not going to put that as soon as you said that.
Thankfully. But, yeah.
We're talking with Ken Horstman, a former state employee. If you're a state employee or anybody else interested in state government, its effectiveness, its efficiency, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Part of the solution may be streamline the organizational structure and have some continuity in it and have some history in it by having a director instead of a deputy commissioner. What do you think? Ken, one of the pushbacks on this is elections are meant to mean something, and a way to have a governor's agenda implemented is through his political appointees. If you take away some of that, does that decrease his effectiveness of getting his agenda done?
I want to divorce policy from effective management. They go hand in glove, obviously. I'm not trying in any way, shape, or form to diminish the ability of a governor to try to implement his or her agenda and to use their appointees in ways that they feel appropriate for to make that happen. What I'm saying is we have a workforce. We have thousands of workers right now, and I'm under no illusion that the general public has this warm and fuzzy sort of perspective about state employees. Believe me, perhaps they should, because if we don't have effective workforce, if we don't have our workers working to optimum performance that feel valued and are working to best benefit, we're all shortchanged as taxpayers. So I don't think that this has anything to do with the ability of a governor to implement, and they're right, to implement their agenda. To me, it's all about making government run as well as it can run.
Couldn't an argument be made that political appointees bring a new way of looking at things, a new way of doing things, infusing a different way of thinking?
Sure. And I think that as long as those political appointees are working with good, solid institutional knowledge, his history, context, perspective, which a longtime classified employee could provide, absolutely. I think that's a very good point.
I find this conversation fascinating, and we'll return to it in just a moment. And by the way, in my experience, I think you raise a really good point. In my experience in state government, state employees work hard, and that should not be overlooked by Vermonters. They do work hard. So we'll come back to Ken Horstman, former state employee, who's talking about making government more effective, more efficient, perhaps by eliminating a layer of political appointees. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We're speaking here in studio with Ken Horstman, longtime former state employee. And one of the things that we're discussing, political appointees, do some of them get in the way and hinder government effectiveness and efficiency? We're posing that question this morning. If you have an opinion, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. If you're a state employee and have experience in this, give us a call. Why are you so passionate about this, Ken? Because there is passion in your voice.
I'm passionate about it, Mike, because I saw for 16 years state workers really trying very hard, who care very deeply, working in a very difficult situation. The year I've been retired a year now, and in the year that when I left in that period of time in a very small department, 5 of 8 senior people left, and there's been a sixth with the EB-5 director leaving in the last couple of weeks. We're losing good people. We're not listening to line workers who have good input. I think in the 16 years that I was in the agency of commerce, perhaps 3 times I was asked my opinion on what kind of policy the governor ought to be considering. Now, for the last half of my job, my years in state service, my job was to go out and visit companies all across the state and help connect them up with services to help them stay here and grow here. I listened a lot, and I heard a lot. And I passed that input on with recommendations for policy. Not only once did I not even – I never got an acknowledgement, never mind feedback, on the ideas. And I'm not alone, and I don't want to make this about me, but I will tell you. I saw – if I had a nickel for every countdown retirement app that are on phones across state government, I'd be wealthy. Mm-hmm. People are just doing their time, and that's sad because they have innovative ideas and they want to contribute, and the structural system prevents them from doing that. That's why I'm passionate.
Isn't it more, though, than the structural system? Doesn't it sort of come down from the top, whether a secretary or a commissioner on that?
Absolutely. But again, in defense of them, they are busy people, and they have a short time. And one of the things, every commissioner that would come in, I was the senior person in the department. My title was Senior Economic Development Specialist. They'd see me down and they'd say, Ken, what do I need to know? And one of the first things I would tell them is that you have limited time and you need to focus. And don't get, because you're going to be torn in a gazillion different directions. And that's what happens invariably. And one of the casualties of that reality are workers, are the state workers who really, they're there after they're gone. And then they start all over. And it's this revolving door system that we really have to take a really hard look at.
One of the things with a proposal where you sort of start to flatten the organizational structure, you eliminate some, not all, of the political appointee positions. But there's this fear out there of a bureaucracy running amok.
Mm-hmm.
How do you sort of allay those fears?
Well, I think that the political appointees would be a key beneficiary of a workforce that brings institutional memory and history. I'll tell you just a quick anecdote. One incoming commissioner during the Douglas years, and it was the last commissioner appointed. It was 3 months into Jim Douglas's term before this commissioner was appointed. And instead of sitting down and saying, okay, what do I need to know? He went willy-nilly into the job. And his first meeting, which wasn't even in state government, was with a person who had an injunction issued against them, okay, because he was a perennial, just difficult person who really, really was just disturbed. He didn't ask. And I think had he asked, there would have been a little bit more of an intelligent approach to it. That happens time and time and time again. The appointees would benefit, I believe, if there was really a more streamlined and effective way for workers to have a voice and to be empowered.
That's where I'm sort of struggling with this concept, because any good manager, any good, whether it's a political appointee or not a political appointee, will seek out those voices, will ask those questions. And I'm curious, is it structure or is it people?
A little of both. I think it's a little of both. You know, in my past life, I managed as up to 30 people in an organization in Florida. And I felt that for me to be doing a good job, half my time really had to be focused on working with my workforce to help them grow professionally and for me to learn from them. And if I wasn't spending that much time, then I probably was shortchanging them and myself. And I think that happens across state government. And it inures to the detriment of every Vermont taxpayer in having a workforce that is really not performing up to par to no fault of their own.
Of course, it's not only the executive branch of the legislature sometimes even hampers this. For example, one of the proposals in the legislature this year was to split up the Agency of Human Services. Now, not too many people in the agency thought that was a great idea. I suspect that leads to some to question or at least demoralize some people out there.
Oh, I think you're right. You know, democracy's messy and, you know, not always doesn't go as well as we want, as quickly as we want. God knows we're seeing that in Washington, you know, today. But I just think that if all parties involved in this important dialogue would value the input of and the experience of a workforce that's been doing it for a long time, we'd all be better off.
Let me ask this question. If you had to advise the incoming governor, and remember in a transition there's a lot going on, what would you say to them?
I would say that this individual should listen as much as possible. I've exchanged emails with Jim Condos, and I know you talked with him recently on this committee to restructure state government. And he does agree with me that this is an issue. His solution is a four-year term. I support that, but I don't think it fully solves the problem. I think, number one, acknowledge that we have an issue, that we have a problem, Governor. And that would go a long way, I think, in really saying, okay, let's think about how we can make sure that you know, the adversarial relationship of collective bargaining between VSEA and the administration doesn't get in the way.
What are you doing now?
I am living the dream. I am retired and just enjoying, you know, the time to wake up in the morning and say, well, what will I do today? I'm doing a little delivery of cars for dealerships driving around the Northeast. I love to drive. I'm not playing as much golf as I'd like to be playing, but I'm really, really enjoying my time off.
Ken Horstman, thank you very much
thank
for
you,
coming
Mike.
In.
Thank you.
Interesting topic, very appropriate topic. Be interested at some point of returning to this topic. Coming up, Talk Media News, and then Neil Goswami, Vermont Press Bureau. He'll be talking about the happenings at the Philly Convention, and then Shap Smith, Democratic candidate for Lieutenant Governor. He'll be in studio and be talking about the various issues that are going on there. Just quickly, for tomorrow, 7 days, political editor Paul Hines and Rutland Herald and Times Argus editorial writer David Motes will be on the Open Mic Show. This is Open Mic, and you are listening to locally owned and operated WDEV News Radio on the Friendly Pioneer, celebrating its 85th year anniversary this year. 85 years, WDEV News Radio, celebrating the future. WDEV AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury and Montpelier, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie and Serving the Kingdom at 101.9 FM from Island Pond. Of course, streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. I'm Mike Smith. We'll be back in a moment. I'm Mike Smith. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It's my pleasure to welcome to Open Mic Victoria Jones. Victoria, good morning.
Good morning to you.
How do you view the convention is going thus far?
Well, there is a sense here of increasing unity, that things are building in an arc towards tonight, if it keeps going that way, that is. And and that is, of course, the hope. That that things really will come together for Hillary Clinton tonight, and of course that she needs to give the speech of her life. Somehow she has to top some really excellent speeches last night. Not that it's a competition, but in a funny way it is.
Has the convention moved past the email controversy?
Well, it thinks it has, of course. You know, it wants to believe that it has. Yes, I think in a way it has, but in a way it hasn't, because Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the outgoing, the erstwhile, if you like, chair of the Democratic National Committee, I don't know that she's lurking or looming, but she was going to gavel in the convention. I still haven't heard whether she's going to gavel out the convention. It would be an astonishingly bad decision if she was going to gavel out the convention, and I very much doubt that she is. So, they still don't have a new chair for the Democratic National Committee, and there are a lot of decisions to be made. No, what is now the background to this, of course, is Donald Trump's extraordinary remarks at that bizarre press conference yesterday.
And Donald Trump basically invited the Russians to try to find the 30,000 missing emails of Hillary Clinton. Is that what you're referring to?
Yes, exactly.
What? Getting back, a couple things on this email, and then let's go on to Hillary Clinton's speech tonight.
Yes.
One, on the emails, I was surprised, and Victoria, it'd be interested if you've heard any sort of rumblings about this, that only Debbie Wasserman Schultz has resigned. There were a lot of people on those emails that were going back and forth. Is there any clamoring for their resignation as well?
Well, there were people close to the resignation, congressmen and people who were talking off the record or on background, who were saying that they expect other fairly high-level people within the Democratic National Committee to resign. But I don't think that anybody was going to go necessarily during the convention, because it would have been the talk of the convention rather than convention itself. So perhaps people will go after the convention, quietly.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I'm curious about, and to get your perspective, there is an expectation that this is only the first wave of emails that are going to be released. There is an expectation that there'll be another wave of emails. Is that the expectation?
More than one way. Well, you see, Julian Assange certainly is thought to have it in for Hillary Clinton. It's thought there could be more than one wave of emails at any time, and maybe time to be embarrassing, like just before a debate, for example. That would be awkward.
What does Hillary Clinton have to do tonight?
She has to come across as very personable, as more than, likable enough, as Barack Obama once so memorably said, and of course he's made it very clear that he thinks of her as far more than that now. And she has to come across as ready to be commander in chief, which I think will not be a really big lift. But she also has to come across as approachable, as friendly, as a warm human being. She has to come across as the Hillary Clinton that in the spring of 1971 I met a girl. As President Obama said, as President Clinton said on Tuesday night, she has to come across as Chelsea Clinton's mom. And we're going to hear about that tonight from Chelsea Clinton, who will introduce her. She has to come across as a woman who, as more than one congresswoman told me yesterday in interviews, and as friends spoke about on the stage during the course of this week, you know, people were saying, and I've heard this from numerous people this week, you know, when I had surgery, congresswoman told me yesterday, she was the first person to call to see how I was. Other person told me, and I'm not going to say who it was, that they were desperately trying to get pregnant and were going through procedures. Who was it who was always who called them to see how it went? It was Hillary Clinton, who stayed with them throughout this very difficult and trying time. She was the one who was always there for them, and it's this kind of quiet thing that she does. But she does it quietly, you see, and people don't know about it. And she's very private, and she protects herself because she's always lived in the glare of the light. And because of that, people don't see this side of her. She has to start getting this across to the American people. I don't know whether she can do it, and she's got to do it in 3 months.
You brought up one of the things that she has to do. All of this, of course, is to boost those numbers, which are worrisome, I would say, what is called the trust factor.
Yes.
How does she do that by doing what you just said?
Oh, I think that's a big piece of it, because look, if I'm standing in the checkout line in Costco and I'm having a conversation with somebody, that's the kind of thing that people think about. It's the kind of story like President Clinton told when they took Chelsea to Stanford the first time, and she didn't want to leave because she kept looking for one more drawer to put paper liner in, and President Clinton knew it was because she didn't want to leave Chelsea behind for the first time. That's the kind of thing somebody relates to. It's not trustworthiness itself, but that's the trust factor.
If I had to look at two people who have gone off script during this convention, one was Governor Martin O'Malley when he went off script saying that the Pacific Trade Agreement is not totally dead in a Clinton administration. That obviously he was shut down fairly quickly,
yeah,
in terms of that. Also, Sarah Silverman telling Bernie supporters, basically, get over it.
Oh, that was considered very, very on script, telling them to stop being ridiculous. That's gone down very well.
So, any other sort of off script that we haven't heard of?
No. Because the thing about this convention is, outside the convention, there have been arrests, there's been fence scaling, there's been flag burnings. Two or three of them, at least two anyway, people managed to set themselves on fire. But there have been marches. There were marches Monday and Tuesday, no marches yesterday. So there's been all that going on off-site. But on-site, it has been really very well greased and very much exactly as they have planned, with the exception of some of the responses in the room, some of the boos and things like that. But they anticipated that. But in terms of what's happened on stage, it has gone very much as planned.
Got about 30 seconds. I've got one more question. Michelle Obama said, and I thought she did a very good speech, she said, if they go low, we go high. But isn't it, in truth, going to be a very, very nasty campaign on both sides this time around?
I think it's going to be horrible.
Hey, Victoria, thank you as always.
Thank you so much.
Victoria Jones, Talk Media News. Coming up, Neil Goswami of the Vermont Press Bureau will be asking him some of the reaction of the Vermont delegation at the Philadelphia Democratic National Convention. This is Open Mic. It's my pleasure to welcome to the Open Mic program Neil Goswami, a Vermont Press Bureau reporter who writes for the Rutland Herald, Times, Argus. Good morning, Neil.
Hey, good morning. Good to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you. Let me start out by, what's the reaction of the Vermont delegation in terms of how the convention is going thus far?
You know, overall, I think most people are pretty pleased with the convention, as has been, I think, pretty well reported in the Vermont media. There were two delegates, Bernie Sanders delegates, that opted to leave the convention after the nomination vote on Tuesday, when Hillary Clinton secured the nomination There is some lingering discontent within the arena among Bernie Sanders delegates. But, you know, I think a lot of them understand that they were coming into this convention with the knowledge that Hillary Clinton really had the votes to secure the nomination and Bernie Sanders was not going to be the nominee. But, you know, there is that lingering discontent, and two Vermont delegates have opted to go home early.
Is there any more that the Vermont delegation is asking for, given the fact that they were predominantly Sanders supporters? For example, Debbie Wasserman Schultz has resigned, as Bernie Sanders wanted her to do. Is there a lingering feeling that others should resign because the DNC put sort of their foot on the scale in favor of Hillary Clinton?
You know, I think that for some delegates, they're probably wanting more from the DNC at this point. I'm not sure how much more they will get. As Debbie Wasserman Schultz departs after this convention, I'm sure more top staffers will follow her out the door. But, you know, who knows if that's going to be enough to placate these Sanders delegates who are upset and who do believe that the DNC had their fingers on the scale in favor of Hillary Clinton. It seems to me that whatever their demands might be, they're probably never going to be fully satisfied at this point. The nomination process is over. The Democratic Party has a nominee. And now there are folks, including Bernie Sanders himself, who are looking to rally his delegates and make the case for why they need to support Hillary Clinton at this point. And their case is really that Donald Trump is just far too dangerous for the country. And not coming together behind Hillary Clinton would be bad for the country.
Is Bernie Sanders still there?
He is. He is. He was around yesterday. And I understand he will be there tonight when Hillary Clinton gives her acceptance speech.
Of course, the governor and Senator Leahy didn't support Sanders. Has all been forgiven from the Sanders side?
You know, there were some folks that spoke yesterday. Senator Leahy was among them. Governor Shumlin spoke today. You know, they talk about the disappointment that Sanders delegates must be feeling. And, you know, they're really doing their best to talk about the difference that Senator Sanders made in this campaign. And they talk a lot about the platform that Bernie Sanders influenced, $15 minimum wage, the Trans-Pacific Partnership deal, and their opposition to it. They talk a lot about the tuition plan, college tuition plan, that Hillary Clinton moved closer to Senator Sanders on. So they're making the effort to acknowledge the real disappointment that Sanders supporters feel, but also to acknowledge the success that the Bernie Sanders campaign had in shaping the message of the Democratic Party moving forward.
Two people went off script in this convention. One was Martin O'Malley. Governor Martin O'Malley went off script saying that the Pacific Trade Agreement is not really totally dead in a Clinton administration. He was quickly reprimanded, and certainly there was a clarification that was made that that's not the case. And then Sarah Silverman saying to Bernie supporters, "Get over it." Are they suspicious of the Clinton campaign, given what they've heard?
There's absolutely suspicion there. You know, in speaking to some of the Bernie Sanders delegates from Vermont, they do question whether Hillary Clinton will follow through and sort of walk the walk on the talk that she's been offering. The Trans-Pacific Partnership deal is really one of those. I think you're referring to Terry McAuliffe, the governor of Virginia.
I'm sorry, it is Terry McAuliffe.
Yeah, and he came out and said, you know, that it's really not dead. He quickly worked to walk that back. I'm sure that is something that the Clinton campaign was furious about, because at this time when they're really pushing for unity, that certainly doesn't help skeptical Sanders supporters. But it is very much alive, this skepticism. And, you know, you've also brought up Sarah Silverman. I actually think that her comments were helpful to the unity movement, because here you have pretty much the most high-profile celebrity endorser of Bernie Sanders saying to them, you know, hey, take a moment here, step back and look at what you're doing and saying. And she called them out as being ridiculous. And for some, I'm sure that was a little tough medicine to take, and for some it probably did drive the message home that, you know, failing to be unified might mean a Donald Trump presidency. So I think it's too soon to say what real long-lasting impact it will have, but I actually think in the long run that might have been a good thing for the party.
One of the things that Michelle Obama said, and I thought she actually did a very, very good job at the convention, was she said, if they go low, we go high. But if you sort of look at the speakers that have followed her, it's going to be a rough political campaign. Does the Vermont delegation sort of share that opinion that it's going to be a rough political campaign?
I think everyone acknowledges it's going to be a pretty rough political campaign. I mean, we've seen we watched the RNC convention last week, and it was almost exclusively about tearing Hillary Clinton down. This week here in Philadelphia with the Democrats, we see sort of a mix between trying to tear Donald Trump down and build up Hillary Clinton's credentials. Last night was a really good example. You had the vice presidential nominee Tim Kaine, the senator from Virginia, who sort of split his remarks between calling out Donald Trump for various things and praising Hillary Clinton for various things. And you had Martin O'Malley, the former Maryland governor, rehashing his old line about Donald Trump being a immigrant-bashing carnival barker. You even had the president of the United States say that Donald Trump was a homegrown demagogue. And I think that phraseology is pretty remarkable. A homegrown demagogue, that word homegrown, we usually hear referenced in a different way when we talk about homegrown terrorism. And I don't think that was a coincidence. I think that was a carefully chosen phrase to try and paint Donald Trump as dangerous. So we're seeing sort of a split convention here in terms of messaging, partially about making the case against Donald Trump and partially about making the case for Hillary Clinton.
Neil, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Neil Goswami, Vermont Press Bureau. Coming up, Shap Smith, Democratic candidate for Lieutenant Governor. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It's my pleasure to have in our WDEV studio Shap Smith, Democratic candidate for Lieutenant Governor. Good morning, Shap.
Morning.
Let's get right to it. We got 30 minutes, and so let's try to cram in as much as we can. Some will be, you know, I'll push a little bit on this. And let's come out of the blocks with that. The business community was kind of peeved at you at the end of the legislative session for what they believe was submarining the independent contractor legislation, and they sort of blame you. Why'd you hold the bill and wait until the last minute to send it to the Senate?
Well, I mean, the independent contractor question really is about redefining what a workforce in the state looks like, and it's an issue that's facing businesses all around the country and employees all around the country. My concern is this. What was proposed under the law would have allowed companies that have employees now to redefine those employees as independent contractors and basically shift all obligations onto employees rather than employers. So healthcare benefits, workers' comp. The way that the bill was drafted, I thought, was really problematic. I do believe that we have to figure out how to address this issue of independent contractors in the new economy, but I thought that the bill that was proposed didn't work the way that it should. And, you know, I had lots of conversations with the business community and lots of conversations with the labor community. And frankly, the labor community was almost as unhappy with me as the business community was, because I believe that we've got to deal with this issue, but we have to do it in an even-handed manner.
The hit on you, and I've done this with every candidate, the hit on you is sometimes you come across as arrogant. How do you respond to that?
I think that you can't deny that perception. I mean, I think that sometimes I'm trying to answer the questions to demonstrate that I have an understanding of the issues. And you know, I've heard it from my kids before. So I think it is it's a challenge. I think a lot of people will also say that I'm a really good listener and that I'm always trying to figure out how to bridge gaps. So, you know, I think at the end of the day, I'm someone who tries to bring people together, find the way to move in the right direction. And at my very heart, as somebody who grew up in here in Vermont, what I'm really trying to do is to work with other Vermonters to make sure that this is a better place for the next generation.
Healthcare is a top priority of yours, and yet detractors will say that as Speaker of the House, you own the mess of Vermont Health Connect because you led its passage through the House and failed in its oversight. How do you respond to that?
Well, here's the thing. We had to have a healthcare exchange, and the federal exchange didn't work very well out of the gates either, and people still complain about the federal exchange. That was a federal requirement, and we had to do it. I was not the person that was writing code, nor was I the person that was managing the project. We have consistently registered our concerns with the administration, the question is, and the question that will be answered from a analysis that we're having done is, at this point in time, do we need to move to a federal exchange or not, and what are the consequences of doing that? I will say I made some calls. I'm making calls all around the state right now. I have had people say to me that the getting health care through their exchange has made a big difference in their lives. That doesn't mean that a lot of people aren't having problems, and we have to recognize that. But for a lot of people, the subsidies that they got under the exchange has allowed them to have health care coverage for the first time in a really long time.
Let's change the subject with health care, and let's say that you could wave a magic wand and design the health care system that you would want to see that would make sure that people have access, that it's affordable, and that we have a quality health care system. What would that look like under Shep Smith?
If you were going to start from scratch, you would never design the system that we have. And let me just speak from personal experience. My wife, in the last year, has gone through a bout with breast cancer. The care has been phenomenal. I have stood at our kitchen table and at the kitchen counter trying to figure out how much we owe, and it is impossible, particularly if you have high deductible plans. We've had to pay $7,000 out of pocket. I'm thankful that we've had insurance, but for many families, that would be the difference between solvency and bankruptcy. We really need to address that issue. And if you were going to design a system, I believe that you would design a publicly financed system with private healthcare providers that would allow everybody to have access in this state to healthcare coverage.
Is it similar to a Medicare for all?
I think that a Medicare for all system would make sense. And, you know, we've talked about it a lot. Why is it okay for people over 65 to have access to publicly financed health care and no other citizens for the state of Vermont or in this country? Every industrialized country has some sort of publicly financed health care system. We don't. I think that we're out of the mainstream on this one.
How would you pay for that?
I think it's going to have to be paid for through public financing. How do we pay for it now? It comes out of people's pockets now. The question is whether you're going to evenly distribute who gets health care. And, you know, even for people who don't have health care coverage now, we're all paying for it. So, you know, it's just a matter of moving the dollars that are spent and raised around. It's not necessarily a matter of putting more money into the system.
But wouldn't you acknowledge that there's huge skepticism, primarily because of Vermont Health Connect, in terms of a government sort of operated system? And how do you overcome that skepticism?
Well, I find it ironic that many people who criticize Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act, particularly the Republicans, also demagogue the issue of Democrats possibly taking away their Medicare. So publicly financed health care is very popular if you look at it from a Medicare perspective. So I think that a lot of Americans And a lot of Vermonters understand that Medicare is a big deal and is a publicly financed healthcare system. Dr. Dinosaur, which is one of the most popular programs in the state's history, provides healthcare coverage for Vermont's kids. People understand that publicly financed healthcare works for our kids and works for our elderly. Why can't it work for everybody else?
How would you control the spending? And that seems to be the issue in terms of the cost, the cost of healthcare. How would you control that? Because everybody makes promises that they're going to save in healthcare, and it never materializes.
Well, you know, that's not necessarily true. This year, when we had a downgrade in our revenues, the reasons that we were able to balance the budget is that we also had lower spending in Medicaid in this past fiscal year in 2016. So, and we have a projected lower growth rate in Medicaid next year. So the way that you're going to control costs is you're going to move away from a fee-for-service model, and you're going to actually pay for performance, and you're going to move forward with, I believe, a payment waiver method like what we're doing through OneCare.
Just one more question on healthcare. But the Medicaid example that you brought up, is it because of lower expenditures in the cost of healthcare, or is it because there are fewer participants in that program?
I don't think that we understand completely why the number went down, and I think that probably both contributed to it.
Downtown redevelopment is another priority of yours. What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean is that if you talk to young people and old people, like, what they're looking for is living in communities where they can walk, live, and play, and work. And if you look around at many of the vital and revitalized communities in the state, they have put public resources into their downtowns. If you go to St. Albans City with the new streetscape there and the investments in a new hotel and in businesses there, if you go to Winooski, if you go to Berry City, what you're seeing is communities that are coming back and that are being revitalized are ones that are investing in their core downtowns so that people have places that they can go to shop, where they can go to work, where they can live and be able to walk to the movies or walk to a restaurant or walk to their job. I think that's going to be part of the economic revitalization for the state of Vermont.
Is it a philosophy of build it and they will come?
I think that it is a philosophy of people want it and we should build it. And the reality is that it is cheaper to build on a cornfield than it is to build on a brownfield. And we've got to figure out a way to build in places where denser development can happen. And we've got to figure out a way to make it less expensive.
We're speaking with Shap Smith, who's a Democratic candidate for lieutenant governor. He'll be running with against two other Democratic candidates. We've had both of them on the program this week. If you wish to join our conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Give us a call if you have a question or a comment. Shap, do you regret overriding Governor Douglas's budget?
No, I don't, because at that point in time, he was trying to put $60 million of general fund obligation into the education fund. And I believe that it would have led to even higher property taxes than we have now. And I believe that that would have been a disaster for Vermont's property taxpayers. So my view is that we made the right call. I wish that we had had more time to negotiate. But at that point in time, I just we could not come to agreement. And I can tell you that I spent a lot of time behind the scenes in one-on-one meetings with people in the administration trying to figure out a way to come to agreement, and we just weren't able to.
Does Vermont have a revenue problem, meaning we need more taxes or a way of taxation, or an expenditure problem, meaning spending?
I think that we have a stability of revenue problem. One of the challenges that we have is the fluctuation of our income tax revenue, and We rely heavily on income tax revenue, and that's a challenge. I do believe that we're making progress on bringing our expenditures down, and we have more progress that we have to make.
We're speaking with Shap Smith, Democratic candidate for Lieutenant Governor. We'll take your calls after we come back from the break. The number is 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. If you have a question or a comment for Shap Smith, give us a call. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. In studio with me this morning is Shap Smith, Democratic candidate for Lieutenant Governor. If you wish to join our conversation, if you have a comment, concern, opinion, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. I will give you a little heads up. If you want to call, you better call pretty quickly. We got about 14 minutes left, and I want to get to a lot of issues here. Gun control, number one issue?
I think it's an issue that we should pay attention to. I think that we need to make sure that this state is as safe as possible. There are issues around domestic violence and guns, and we need to deal with them.
AHS, split up or keep it together? Because there's a proposal that came from the Senate, went to the House, actually, that wanted to split that agency up into two agencies, one that would deal just with health care and the other that would deal with the human services type of activities. What's your position?
I'm open to looking at splitting it up.
Black lives matter or all lives matter?
Black lives matter and all lives matter. I think that we have to recognize that there is significant racial tension within this country. And that we're not doing as well as we should, and we ought to be focused on it.
Let's go to the phone line. Let's go to Rich in East Montpelier. Rich, you're on Open Mic with Shap Smith.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. So, you know, I'm really tired of hearing about gun control and better gun laws and all this. Let me throw something into the ring. How about if you're going to purchase a firearm, treat it like a motor vehicle? You have to have a license before you're allowed to drive a motor vehicle. Why shouldn't you have to attend a gun safety course, not a hunter safety course, a gun safety course before you're allowed to purchase a firearm? And then once you've completed that, you still have a 7-day waiting period.
Shap?
Well, you know, I had to take my hunter safety course when I was growing up. I remember doing it at Coots Moriarty, Camp Coots Moriarty up in Derby when in high school. So we do require that at least for being able to hunt.
Well, that's to be able to hunt. I'm talking about to be able to purchase a firearm. You have to go through a firearm safety course and be able to accomplish it.
I've never heard that before. I'd like to hear more about it.
Don't you think that's a good idea? To prove that you have the ability to handle a firearm before you're allowed to purchase one?
I haven't given it much thought, frankly.
Would you consider it?
I would consider it.
You know, never mind all the other things that they're doing that don't do any good. Make sure somebody has the capacity and understands what a firearm is before they're allowed to purchase one. It has nothing to do with hunting. It's purchasing the firearm.
Thanks, Rich, for the phone call. Let's continue with some of these rapid-fire ones, and then we'll take phone calls. If you want to join our conversation, got to hurry. 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. Industrial wind and solar siting, still broken or did you fix it?
I do think that we fixed it. We gave communities an opportunity to have real input into state plans around siting, and I think that that will make a difference.
Opponents still aren't happy. They don't think there's enough input. You think you should revisit that?
Well, I think that we ought to see how it works before we criticize it.
PSB process, fine or it needs to be fixed?
So I do think that we've got to figure out a way that Vermonters feel like they're heard better, because it definitely is a concern that I hear across the state.
Let's go to Barb in South Burlington. Barb, you're on Open Mic with Shap Smith.
Hi, good morning. Good morning, Shap. I'm back to the gun issue. I understand guns in Vermont are popular and hunting and all that. What I don't understand is the assault weapons that fire, you know, 30 rounds in a minute or whatever. Why are these legal? Why are they allowed? And why can't we do away with the assault weapons?
I don't know whether states have assault weapon bans at the state level. Some may. You know, when I've talked with a bunch of the gun control groups, the focus that they've set has been on child safety locks, making sure that we have universal background checks. So I'll take a look at the assault weapons ban as well.
Thanks, Barb, for your phone call. Let's talk a little bit about the Rutland Syrian refugee. I don't want to get into whether they should come or not come. That's a discussion for Rutland to have. What was the process, the best process, or does it need to be better?
This whole issue puzzles me. And as somebody whose sister-in-law is somebody who came to this country as a refugee and was educated in the public school system, ended up going to college here, ended up being a productive member of society. The frustrating part about this whole discussion is I believe that immigration is the lifeblood and the strength of our society. And I think we're scaring people away from this state, people that we should want to have in this state. And the process by which we are scaring those people, I think, is problematic.
One of the things that opponents down there said, this was dropped on us. And if you take any issue and drop it on us sort of in a surprise, you're going to have this reaction, whether it's windmills or anything else. Do they have a point?
I don't. I've talked with Chris, Mayor Loris, a little bit about this. And, you know, I saw some news stories today where he suggested that they ought to pull together a group to try to get people to talk to each other more effectively. You know, I'll leave that to Chris and the local community to decide whether they thought the process worked. What I believe is immigration is the lifeblood of this state and is the lifeblood of this country. If we hadn't had immigration, we wouldn't have communities like Barry and Rutland that were vibrant throughout history.
Let's go to the phone lines. Let's go to Rob in North Carolina. Rob, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. Good morning, Mr. Schaff. Listen, Comey just came out and warned against terrorist attacks in New York City. Should there be better vetting in the U.S. in general? And how is Vermont's vetting going with these influx of immigrants coming into our state, the state?
I can't speak to the specific vetting, but my understanding is that it's pretty rigorous for people coming into the country.
Let's talk about something. I want to slow it down because this is a big issue. Hydro dams.
Mm-hmm.
The state is looking at purchasing the Connecticut River hydro dams. It's not a new thought. but one of the things that sort of struck me, it's a $1 billion purchase. Mm-hmm. What do you feel about that?
Well, I think that if we can figure out the economic case for it, it makes sense to own those dams. If you look at some of the states and provinces around us that own publicly power, their industrial rates for power are much lower. If you look at Quebec and the public-private partnership that they have with their dams, and if you look at New York State, those assets have been very important to them from an economic perspective. So if we can figure out the economic case, I believe that those are assets that we should own as a state.
One of your opponents has gone after you on taxes. are you a tax and spend liberal?
One of my opponents, the progressive in the race, has suggested that he doesn't like some proposals that I've made, and I actually haven't made those proposals, so I'll just leave it there.
Let's go to Mark and Randolph. Mark, you're on open mic with Shap Smith. Good morning.
Morning. For 3 years now, constituents from all over the state have been asking for a state ethics commission. Reason being, Vermont is one of only three states in the entire country without an ethics commission. I saw like a proposal last year. It was basically the legislators policing themselves, which was kind of like the fox in the hen house. And my main question is, why is Montpelier so against an ethics commission?
I've actually been a strong supporter of an ethics commission. I think that it makes sense. We had a very difficult time getting it through the Senate last year. And it's something that I would support as lieutenant governor. I will say this. New Jersey and other states around the country, I think New York, have ethics commissions. If you see what happens there, it hasn't cleaned up the government, state government there. But I believe that what matters is that constituents and Vermonters have confidence that their legislators and their other state officials and municipal officials are acting in ethical ways.
Thanks, Mark, for your phone call. In New Jersey, of course, it's definitely going to make sure that the governor's office never tries to close down a bridge again. But let's go to EB-5 program. Should we keep it or should we can it?
I think that we need to more rigorously regulate it, but I do think that as an investment tool, it does make sense. I was just down at Mount Snow. It's going to allow them to do huge upgrades to their snowmaking system, and it's going to allow them to make investments that are going to create jobs in that area. So I think if it's properly used, it makes sense, and if it's properly regulated, it makes sense.
I'm going to give you 2 minutes. Tell me why you should be the nominee.
I think over the 8 years that I've been speaker, I have demonstrated that I can bring people together to deal with really difficult issues, whether it's bringing marriage equality across the line, whether it's passing laws with regard to expansion of renewable energy, whether it's addressing issues around child care and making sure that people have a higher minimum wage or paid sick leave. I've worked both within the caucus but across the aisle to solve really tough issues. And as somebody who has lived and worked in Chittenden County but also lives now in Lamoille County, I believe that I bring a perspective to the race, someone who understands the two Vermonts which exist, Chittenden County and to some degree everywhere else. And I think that perspective is really important in the statewide offices. The reason that I'm running is that I believe that I've demonstrated I can bring people together to solve tough issues. And I am fundamentally optimistic about this state. This is a state that I want to see my kids be able to grow up in. And I'm going to bring that optimism to my role as lieutenant governor.
But why you as opposed to David Zuckerman or Keisha Romm?
Because I think I've demonstrated over the 8 years that I can stand at the podium, lead a body, and get things done.
One of the things, and I've only got 30 seconds here, marijuana. Legalizing marijuana, where are you on that?
I believe that marijuana will be legalized, and I have supported it, but I also have things that I believe have to be done before we pass it.
Shap Smith, Democratic candidate for lieutenant governor, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
I want to thank our guest today, Congressman Peter Welch, who called in and we talked about the Democratic convention and other issues of concerns to Vermont. Ken Horstman, and we had a former state employee, we had a fascinating conversation about political appointees. I found that very interesting, being an ex-political appointee myself, and how political appointees hinder government effectiveness and efficiency. And of course, Victoria Jones from Talk Media News, and just a minute ago, Shap Smith, Democratic candidate for lieutenant governor, and Neil Goswami, Vermont Press Bureau, who talked about the happenings at the Philly convention. And one of the things I'm going to start out with tomorrow morning is your opinions about the Democratic National Committee meeting. And then we'll switch to 7 Days political editor Paul Hines and do a wrap-up of the Philadelphia Convention, the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia. And I'm really looking forward to this interview, which is with Rutland Herald Times Argus editorial writer David Motes. And, of course, as I said, your phone calls. This is Open Mic, and you are listening to locally owned and operated WDEV News Radio on the Friendly Pioneer, celebrating its 85th year anniversary this year. Celebrating the future, 85 years, WDEV News Radio. So you're listening on WDEV AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury and Montpelier, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, and serving the kingdom at 101.9 FM from Isle and Pond. Of course, we're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. I'm Mike Smith. Thanks for your phone calls.
The Open Mic Podcast is brought to you by Hickok Boardman, Dennis Ricker, and Brown.
Find us online at hbinsurance.com. And you're always welcome to visit us on Facebook, in Vermont, online, on the phone. Hickok & Boardman Insurance Group. We are here when you need us.